Good afternoon. So as it says on the schedule, this is going to be exam review. The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to take a set of things you want me to talk about. I'm going to put them in some order. I'm going to go through as much of them as we can. If we have more time, I'll ask for a second set of things. And I'm going to use the notes that are currently displaying to keep track of that, and I will upload this file after the lecture so you can look at it. So what things would you like me to talk about? Yeah? Q4, the quiz, which is spectacular, okay. Other things people would like me to talk about? Broadcast the signal for condition variables, yeah. Yeah.
Question one on this means.
Okay. Yeah. TLB, so anything more specific? Okay. Back there. Question six on the 2020 what final? 2024? Spring, fall? Which is about what? Context switching and what?
Interrupts.
And interrupts, okay. Back there. Okay, different types of memory. Can you, what types in the sense of? Okay, so threads and the heap stack, et cetera, okay. Okay, anything more specific about that? These are useful, okay. Yeah.
How about branch prediction?
Branch prediction, anything? Okay, branch prediction, when does squashing happen, okay. And question three on this week's quiz, okay. Anything else? Or, yeah. Okay. Examples. I suspect the quiz will cover that. If you have something specific, we should have something specific. Okay. Not seeing any others right now. Okay. So, gonna go through in rough order and hope I have a way of non-awkwardly pulling up past exams. So, context switch and interrupts exception. So, an exception is the processor runs the OS kernel, you know, because, you know, for some reason. And context switch is the OS changes, sort of unloads the state for one process or thread and loads the state for a new different process or thread. So the only connection between exceptions and context switches is that the OS needs to be running for a context switch to happen. So if we see that process A was running and then process B was running, well, that means something needed to run the OS for a little bit of time in between. That something is some kind of exception. If process A didn't do anything to ask the OS to run, it must have been triggered by an event external to the process. To process A, like input from somewhere, or timer, set up previously, expiring, or something like that. So that's the connection. It's not a direct connection, right? So a context switch isn't like a type of interrupt or exception. The relationship is just that the context switch is something the OS does, not something a program does itself. So the OS needs to be running for some reason. And if we don't know why the OS is running, well, if we go from process A to process B, my first question is, did process A want this to happen for some reason? Like, is process A asked to read from the keyboard, then it kind of wanted it to happen because the process A doesn't want to just sit there while they're waiting for keyboard input. I'll say process A might kind of indirectly ask the OS to run, not to explicitly switch to another program. But the OS might switch anyway. Sort of example, it asks for keyboard input, the OS might decide to switch away because there's no input available right now. But the important thing is the OS needs to run for a context switch to happen, and if you don't know how the OS is running, well, you need to think of a reason why. And what that reason is going to be is going to depend on the context that we're looking at. Questions on our context switch and interrupts, exceptions, etc. Yeah.
Could I explain a timer exception?
Sure. So timer exceptions are sort of the OS wants to make sure, as a last resort, that it runs if a program takes too long. So the solution is the hardware supplies the OS a timer before running process A. The OS sets the timer for, say 1 millisecond. If the OS doesn't reset the timer later, the processor will trigger an exception in 1ms and run the OS, regardless of what the program is doing. So the timer is the mechanism that the OS uses to enforce that if I have an infinite loop, it doesn't hog the system forever. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Timer count as a hardware interrupt. So the timer is an exception that's not triggered by the program. In the terminology in the reading, we call that an interrupt. We're not going to test on that terminology because every processor manual uses interrupt to mean something different. Maybe not literally everyone, but it's pretty close. Like x86, ARM,
a textbook we previously used for this class, for the old version of this class, all differ on what they consider an interrupt. But it's an externally triggered event. And, you know, because the program doesn't do anything to make the timer go off. Does that answer your question? Other things on our exceptions versus counter switches? Yeah. IO exceptions. So, so this is input from somewhere, or out device is ready for output. So generally, so I guess IO and exceptions. When IO devices, sort of devices, devices need attention from the OS, they can ask the processor to run the OS. When do they need attention? When they have input ready for the OS to do something with. When the OS might want to send output, and they are now ready to receive that output and weren't before. But weren't before. Does that answer your question? So notice that this is not every time we access an I/O device. It's just when, for some reason, the I/O device needs to get the OS's attention. So it's not every time a program accesses an I/O device, you know, just when the OS wouldn't otherwise be trying to handle that I/O. Does that make sense? Other questions? Yeah. When one process is running computations and there's a switch, so we have to ask the question, why did the process stop running? And the context will depend on the answer. If the process was not doing anything and there's no devices that need attention, then probably it's a timer interrupt by process of elimination. If we know that the other process was like waiting for input and now that input's available, like it could be a timer interrupt, but probably more likely the OS found out that the input was ready and decided to switch the program based on that. Does that answer your question? Okay, so then we have fall 2024, must be what I meant to write. For Q6 signals. So if I pull up fall 2024 question 6, okay. So this question says we have a chat program like the signals lab. And the question is, we send a message, what exceptions happen? So before we send the message, sort of both programs have set up a shared memory region, and both programs are waiting, have set up a signal handler. And both programs are waiting for keyboard input, for terminal input. I say keyboard construed broadly because probably it's two SSH connections. And probably, you know, almost certainly, the OS is running something that is not these programs because
why would we run a program that can't do anything until it gets input?
Because they can't do anything until they get input.
So the first thing which needs to happen is we need some, the OS needs to get that input from the terminal. So we're going to have some sort of IO exception to tell the OS there's input available for this program. You know, that could be like from an SSH connection, something coming in on the network, or keyboard physically in front of the machine. But there needs to be some sort of thing that says, hey, there's input from this user. That needs to be handled, and that's the OS needs to handle that. And there's going to be some process which gets that to the program. So that's one of our necessary exceptions. In the question, you know, we have kind of something we accepted, but is not necessarily required, which is that possibly the OS might get the input, but not run the chat program right away. If so, we might need a timer interrupt before the OS switches. And this is an option because this just depends on, you know, depending on how much, you know, how much the OS likes switching away from programs. Because there's a performance, so, you know, that's a decision that the OS gets to make. When I get keyboard input, do I actually, like, go to that program right away, or do I wait just so I don't, like, slow down the current program? You know, and if you think of something like Portal, like if we switched away from programs all the time, maybe that would not be great. So, but that was an option. That's not my canonical, I wouldn't say that's a canonical answer, but it's in the keys, so that's why I'm mentioning it. And then the chat program will get the input. And this is going to be the return value based system call, which was triggered here. So this was done with a system call. But that system call happened earlier, it just hasn't finished. But the event where the kernel started running happened already, before we actually sent a message. Then the chat program will store the input in the shared memory, and this doesn't require any exceptions because assuming the memory is already sort of in our page table. Now, even though it's the same as the other program, we're just accessing something through the page table. It doesn't matter that it happens to be the same physical page as some other program. Then the chat program will send a signal, and this is a requires a system call because we can't just directly manipulate other processes and have them run. The OS will eventually run the signal handler. It, you know, could do this immediately during the signal handler, system call to send the signal, or could do it later in response to some other exception. But the simplest case is it just does it immediately. Then the other chat program will output to the terminal, which is another system call. Yeah?
Could you explain more about like what the shared memory between two processes is?
So the question is, can I explain what the shared memory for the process is? So in the signal chat example, in our signals lab, we didn't fork. So the way this shared memory worked is that we explicitly told the OS, hey, I'd like to have access to the same memory as this other program using a specific, I'll have a name for this region. And I'd like all programs using that name to have the same memory.
So there's no fork involved. It was just, we just explicitly said, please give every program that asks for this name this piece of memory. Now, when we fork, if we're only reading because of copy and write, usually we actually would have the same memory. It's only when we write that the OS actually splits that up. But that's a different issue because we didn't fork in the signals limit. That answer your question? So question, does the kernel process have its own cache table? So I would say in the most common OS design, the kernel isn't a separate process. It's something which can kind of run as a part of every process. And typically, it has some virtual addresses reserved for it, where it basically uses part of your page table, but that part of the page table is marked as kernel mode only, so you can't access it. Does that answer your question? Okay, so that's on signals. Let's talk cache write policies. So let's say processor requests to write X, write to address X, value Y. And that the cache block that would contain address X, there's X, ranges from, say, X minus 4. Now let's say we'll write, actually, let's just make this more explicit. Write 2 bytes to OX104, with value, 1, 2, 3, 4. And the cache block containing OX14 ranges from addresses 1 through OX10F inclusive. So that's our setup. We're going to talk about write policies in that context. So the cache will sort of have cache's flow chart. Is first look up address OX104 in the cache. If it's not present, then if a write allocate cache, add it to the cache, and if a write no allocate cache, stop now. Stop. Just access memory, just send the write to the next level. So this is where write allocate comes in. Is it just only if the value's not in the cache? We just stop right away, just don't keep going with our whole cache access stuff, we're done. And we just go to the next level, and we don't continue processing the access at all. Notice that this only applies if it's not present. If it's present, write allocate doesn't matter. So if adding it to the cache, we need to read 03 and 06 inclusive from the next level. Because in order to add it from the cache, yes, we have the value that goes in 2 of these bytes, but that's not the whole cache block. So if we are actually adding it to the cache, we have to actually read the rest of that value. It doesn't help us that much that we have the value being written, because we're not writing the whole cache block almost all of the time. So then, assuming we get past this step, then we have to say, then we're always going to modify sort of offsets, in this case, 4 and 5 of the cache block to contain OX1234. We have to store the value we're writing in the cache.
assuming you've gotten this far. And then now we have a decision. So if a write through cache the OX1234 send the write to of OX1234 to bytes 4 through OX105 to the next level. So if it's a write through cache, we're just going to also send that write to the next level. You know, not enough that we just put it in the cache. If it's a write back cache, we're going to mark the block as dirty. And a write through cache, note that we write through cache means no dirty bits. We cannot mark the block as dirty. We just don't have a way of doing that. So this is the normal case. So the second part is, so what about dirty block when we replace something in the cache, regardless of read or write? And this is, I guess, we'll mark this. This is for if a write back cache. If it's dirty, we have to write it to the next level. And we'll write the whole block, you know, and we have to write the whole block because we don't track more detail about what changed. Note that my flowchart, like, you know, write back cache, I just marked the whole thing as dirty. I don't know that, you know, addresses 100 wasn't edited. In that case. Yeah?
I'm confused why we need to,
So the question is, why are we reading these other things?
Yeah,
so the problem is that if the processor reads from OX100, we need to know, we're going to think that value is correctly cached. If we don't read it, we can't give the processor back the right value. Question, wouldn't any changes to that block of addresses be made to the cache itself? Yes, but the problem is the processor might read those value bytes before it writes them. Right.
Okay.
We can write part of the cache block and read the rest. We have to handle that case. And in fact, in practice, it's probably pretty common, unfortunately. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions back there? Okay, so the question is about things never being written in memory. So note that this happens when we replace something. There's nothing that requires us to replace something, even if we let the machine run to like shutting down the system. Right? If it just stays in the cache the whole time, we never write it to the next level. Does that answer your question?
Yes, you're basically saying that like if it never gets overwritten, it can just stay as a dirty bit in the cache.
Yeah, so it never gets overwritten, it just stays there. Yep. Other questions? Okay, so then TLB structure. So our TLB is sort of TLB is a mapping from virtual page numbers. This is And by this, I mean everything in a virtual address that's not the page offset to sort of last level page table entries. And this is going to be the sort of permission bits plus everything plus, you know, physical address.
physical page number. An important part. And so, you know, and TLB is a cache, sort of organized like our memory caches, instead of using an address as input, we use the virtual page number. When we split the input, the VPN, into tag index offset, we have 0 offset bits. So we end up splitting the VPN. So we have the top bits, so we have our virtual page number, and kind of the top bits are going to be our TLB tag, and the bottom bits are going to be our TLB index. And because we have 0 offset bits, we store 1 last level page table entry per block. So the block in this cache is a page table. It's a last level page table entry. And on a TLB hit, we take our virtual page number and page offset. We put this virtual page number through the TLB. And we get a physical page number. And we just copy the page offset. So we just copy this. As is. Plus, we check the permission bits, mission bits retrieved from the TLB to make sure that we aren't writing something as part of that access. So that's my. And in the TLB, so like with a cache, so we use the TLB index to find set, look for a matching tag in the set. If so, we have a hit, and the block contains our page table entry. If not, we add miss, and we load the correct PTE into the TLB. Next time. Questions? Back there, yes. So the question, when we talk about the TLB size, so usually we give you the TLB size in entries, which means page table entries, in which case it's pretty obvious whether the permission bits are included. Generally, the TLB has to contain the permission bits, because otherwise, if we think of having memory that's read-only, right, we can't really implement that and use the TLB if we don't have some of the permission bits in there. Does that answer your question? Yes, no? Okay. Yeah. Can the TLB have more than one way? Yes. And in fact, it is much more common for TLBs to have a lot of ways than it is for regular memory caches to. Just because there's worse spatial locality in TLB accesses. Other questions? Yeah.
The page table entry is just the physical page number plus like valid bit. What else?
The page table entry is the physical page number plus valid bit and permission bits. The valid bit is like the same as the valid bit in our caches in this case, and we don't care about invalid page table entries because there's no, it doesn't help us to cache that. It's going to be slow anyways. Does that answer your question? Okay, so threads and the heap stack, et cetera. So when one process has multiple threads, they all have the same page table, which means that any sort of pointer in one thread, another thread could use. And to make this work, this means that so each thread in a process has a different stack with a different address. Also, each thread in a process, you know, can pass pointers to each other and dereference a pointer created by another thread. You know, but, you know, if the pointer points to something that went out of scope, you know, it's probably not going to work. It's a problem. It won't. Yeah?
If a variable is created on a stack, like in the main thread, and then that thread like splits into two, is that variable copied onto both threads?
The question is, if a variable is created in the main thread and that thread splits into two, so what do you mean by splitting into two?
Okay, if one thread calls
so the question is, do variables get copied by pthread create? No. So pthread create always creates a fresh stack. Different stack. So new kind of empty stack created by pthread create. Stop. Answer your question. Okay. Other questions? I guess since heap was mentioned, I should say, so if a pointer goes out of scope, this can be a problem. So this most commonly comes up with things on another thread stack. Usually not a problem to have pointers to global variables or heap, because those won't go out of scope. You know, by accident. Yes, the heap stuff, you can free it and it goes out of scope, but that's not the problem. Yeah?
So if pthread create is called with an argument, is that automatically copied to the thread stack?
Question, if pthread create is called, is that argument copied to the thread stack? So the argument to pthread that we passed with pthread create is a pointer. And that pointer is copied to the thread. It's probably not stored in the stack, it's probably just in a register. But the pointer's copied, which is probably not what you were thinking of when you said, is the argument copied? Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah, so I'll probably mention that. So usually passing pointers to pthread create through pthread create and pthread create sort of won't copy anything the pointer points to. It just copies the pointer size. That, okay. Anything else on our threads in the heap and stack, etc.? Okay. Broadcast versus signal for condition variables. So remember, sort of my review is condition variables are a list of waiting threads, and broadcast is let all of them run and see if they can do something. And signal is let one of them run and see if it can do something. And generally, you know,
To use pthread cond wait correctly, we always need to double check the condition, sort of while still need to wait. Right. This is how we call pthread cond wait. It's how we have to do it because of spurious wakeups, and also we learned that the timing kind of things. Yeah, when we signal a thread, that doesn't mean that's the first thread that gets to go, because some other thread might sneak in between. This means that, you know, it's safe to broadcast from a correctness point of view. Because the worst that can happen, is a bunch of threads realize they still need to wait. To wait when they double check the condition. Sort of ideally, we'd like to not wake up threads that will just start waiting again. And sometimes we can figure out, you know, we can use signal instead of broadcast as part of doing this. And when can we do that? We have to know that at most one thread can go as a result of our action. Sort of an example is, you know, if we placed one item on a queue and we signal each time and to threads that will remove one item. Well, we know that, you know, we're waking up enough threads to handle the one item. We don't need to wake up more. But if we're not sure, you know, if we can't prove that isn't necessarily the case, we should broadcast. You know, and at least we won't be sort of stalling, hanging when we shouldn't. Is that questions on that? No. And I guess I'll mention it might be the case that the thread we wake up doesn't get to go because another thread snuck in before it and never waited. But that's not a problem. But in typical case, we'll wake up exactly the right number of waiting threads. Right? And we know we're waking up enough threads is the important thing, right? That's the correctness. This is the sort of thing we, you know for correctness. You know, so if we had some different way that this queue worked, you know, if threads, you know, sometimes didn't get an item, if it was there, waking up one thread might not be good enough, for example. They sometimes skip one, for example, something like that. So questions? Broadcast versus signal? Yeah, back there. So the question is, what happens when I signal if no one's waiting? Then
These do nothing. So both do nothing if no one is with. But that shouldn't be a problem. Problem because we always check if we need to wait before waiting and do it with a lock to make sure whether we need to wait doesn't change. Whether we need to wait does not change while we're checking. Does that answer your question? So if we follow the pattern, we have the lock to make sure that we don't say, oh, I need to wait, and start waiting, and sometime in the middle of that, someone else like makes it so we don't need to wait. Okay. So UDP versus TCP. So these are both kind of transport layer, and the transport layer is kind of protocols. And the transport layer has kind of two responsibilities that maybe should have been separated, but aren't on the internet. And one of those responsibilities is kind of organizing data into kind of streams, even though it might not be sent that way that are potentially reliable to streams or reliable, and also getting data to the correct program on machines when there might be multiple. And this is something that TCP does this and kind of implements reliable transmission. UDP does not do this. And TCP and UDP both do handle getting it to the right program, but basically UDP kind of opts out of organizing it into a stream of data that's sent reliably. Not do this. So I guess the question is, so why would you choose UDP over TCP is the question. So one reason would be, if you don't care about reliable transmission, so example would be for a video stream, you might prefer to not resend old data, send old data that was lost, and instead get the most recent sort of video frames. You might say, I'm not going to show, yes, I know we lost like that stuff 10 milliseconds ago, but I'm never showing that. Just don't resend it. And UDP is a way you can achieve that functionality on the internet, which TCP doesn't really like to do. Another might be if you care about reliable transmission, and I guess I'll put parenthetically, and want lower overhead or latency. Another example would be is if you think you can do better than TCP at implementing reliable stream transmission. So an example of this is a QUIC used by some web browsers. It's a protocol which does a lot of the stuff TCP does itself on top of UDP because the web browser people think they can do better. Questions about TCP versus UDP? Yeah, back there.
Correct.
Question, is it only TCP that checks for messages that got dropped or lost along the way, or do other layers do that as well? So TCP is the only layer that's required to do that. The other layers might do that, but it would be an optimization. So for example, in Wi-Fi, it's pretty common to check whether things get transmitted on the Wi-Fi link because wireless is relatively unreliable. But it's uncommon to do that on, say, wired Ethernet because it's reliable enough that that's usually not worth your time, worth the overhead of doing that checking. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and I guess I'll also mention, in either case, like, it wouldn't be good enough for us to have, like, the sort of, like, the link layer protocol check that reliability, because it wouldn't handle certain types of failures. Like, one way things can break is the router could fail to forward the packet. And we kind of need something above that sort of, those lower level checks, regardless, to handle that case. Other questions, TCP versus UDP? Okay, so certificates and certificate authorities, why useful? So we had this idea that, you know, we can communicate securely with a machine if we have its public key, its public keys. The problem is how do we get public keys? And the sort of part one of the modern solution to this is that we ship a list of public keys with OSs and browsers. But we can't include all the public keys for every machine we want to talk to. We can't change this list of public keys fast enough, as fast as the public keys of machines we want to talk to change. So this partial solution, it helps a lot, but it isn't good enough. So part two of the modern solution is that the public keys we ship are for certificate authorities. Those public keys are used to verify with a digital signature that those certificate authorities have are sending us another public key. And for this to make sense, we need to trust the certificate authority to verify other public keys. And sort of open question is this, are they actually trustworthy? Kind of beyond the scope of this class, but complex question. And rather than having the certificate authorities sort of send the public keys directly, we do have them do it indirectly. We have the certificate authorities generate a message for, say, foo.com, saying, I, this certificate authority, think foo.com's public key is X, and foo.com forwards that message to the browser, or, you know, whatever other sort of thing we're using to communicate with foo.com. And that message comes with a digital signature
so we can verify it actually comes from the certificate authority. Okay, and then there's part three of the modern solution, is that it's not practical to have certificate authorities directly sign the messages, sort of the messages for foo.coms, so they delegate it. We use another message from the certificate authority to tell, so browsers can know that it's delegated to a sub-certificate authority. So we end up with what are called certificate chains. And this message is called a certificate, this signed, I know who this public person's public key is. Called certificate change, so browser is sent, certificate one, certificate authority A delegates to certificate authority B with public key Y, certificate two, certificate authority B thinks foo.com's public key is X. And this would be signed by certificate authority A's private key, and this would be signed by certificate authority B's private key. And that's what we sent to the browser. Questions? Yes?
So public key Y is certificate authority B's public key?
Public key Y is certificate authority B's public key.
Oh.
And the public key of certificate authority A has to be shipped with the browser for this to work. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, branch prediction, when does squashing happen? So in our pipeline processor, we keep running the incorrect rect prediction until we compute actual result of the jump. In the pipeline homework, the way this worked is that if we had a jump instruction, we started fetching our prediction during the jump instruction's decode stage, and we computed at this stage, jump should really go, and then in the memory stage, the first time we can fetch based on what we computed was our assumption for how things worked. A different processor, the pipeline could have this happen at different stages. So what we ended up with is that we ran our prediction until we were able to fetch something else. And then we ran the finally fetching based on what was actually computed. And the key reason is because this was the first time we had the information about where to go in time to fetch something.
Right, so if we somehow changed our processor to compute the destination of the jump in the decode stage, we could save a cycle here. And there have been pipeline processors where they carefully structure their branch instruction so they can do that. Yeah, back there? At what stage do we know the jump is complete? We can verify it incorrectly. So in the pipeline assignment, we told you that was the memory stage. And in general, this depends on what kind of, that was at the beginning of the memory stage, we could fetch the new instruction, meaning probably you use the execute math stuff to compute where the jump really goes. This could work differently in a different processor design. That's why we told you in the pipeline homework. And it's a thing that's attractive to make work differently because it has a pretty big effect on performance, but also, like, if you try to compute it earlier, that means that you can't support as complicated or interesting jump instructions. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Is this still considered forwarding, or are you forwarding?
We could call this forwarding. I usually wouldn't, but I wouldn't. I don't think it's crazy to call it forwarding. I would usually not call this forwarding, but it's not. I've seen people call it forwarding, and who know what they're talking about. But I wouldn't call it forwarding. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So then we have a bunch of stuff on next week's quiz. So I need to go to this week's quiz. Okay, so start with question one. I'll separate that from quiz, which is side channel. So this was at, we had a function here that function that checks whether its input matches some rotated version of a secret value. And we learned that it's true for A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, leaf. And so the secret value, I guess I should say hidden string. So hidden string is or B, C, D, A, or, yeah, those are our possibilities. And the way the function works is that it will find, the function x sets, the function works by trying rotations until one returns true. So we can figure out what rotation is actually in a hidden string by seeing which is fastest to return true. So until one matches and then returns true. If it takes longer, the short should have the shortest time from the correct rotation. Correct rotation being first, tested first. Questions on that? Okay, so then question three and four. So question three saying, so the saying that we, this is timing that we had a, we did the probe, we did some pointer access, and we did prime, and then some pointer access and probe, and found out that array index 512, or array, yeah, array index 512 was slow in probe. And array index 512 is going to be, was 0x1400 plus 512, which is cache set 2. Right. Yeah, cache set 2. Because our, with our cache set 2, because the cache has 256 byte blocks. And set index 2. So the correct answers are values in cache set 2 that are not in the array. The array. Sort of addresses that are. Okay. And that's our procedure. So we do the tag index offset split for each of the addresses. We check if they're in the array, because if they're in the array, they shouldn't be evicted. You know, set 2. Cache set 2 means could evict array 512. And not in array means needed to be added to the cache, because they weren't already in it as a result of the prime step. Questions? Logic for that? Yeah. 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 This is question 3. I believe it's question 3. Oh, nope, okay. I went over question 2 by accident. Okay, good work, me. Okay, let's go over question 3. You are correct that I went over the wrong question, because I wasn't reading carefully. Okay, so question 3. So we discovered that array mystery times 2 and array mystery times 3 that sort of accessed cache set indices 514, 515, and 739. And array was address 0x14 through that address plus 1000. And this first address mapped to was cache set index 512. And this last one was, or sorry, 1000 times 4, size of int. This last one, assuming I did my math correctly, was 600 something. So the 739 must be something outside the array. Must be outside the array, probably mystery. Wherever mystery is stored as a global variable. And we know that array of, we have a cache with 32, array of 0 through 3 is cache set 512, array of 4 to 7 is cache set 513, and so on. We can use this to figure out sort of the ranges that array of the cache set 514 and 515 access could have come from. And from that, we know that the 514 access was mystery times 2, and 515 was mystery times 3, assuming, you know, they're in bounds. So we can do that. Then we can just solve for what are the possible values of mystery using the ranges we get based on that. questions on that procedure? Okay, then question four. We had this code here. And we want to do a Spectre style attack here. And the goal of our Spectre style attack is that this cache access, we will learn about the address of this cache access and the address will be computed based on this. So the value we're going to learn about is the socket index value. And what's going to happen is that in attack, the processor will sort of branch predict that this should run, but it will be wrong. And that this means that in the attack, file number socket index will be out of bounds. Out of bounds, you know, and chosen by attacker to match kind of something they want to, some value they want to learn about. And the attacker will choose the address such that when we do the calculation of the out-of-bounds array index, we find out, oh, that's some other, that's, you know, some memory that might be of interest to them. Like, if this is an OS kernel, like, maybe, like, an encryption key for a VPN or something like that. So questions on that? Yes, got there? How do we know what will be exposed to the Spectre attack? So the Spectre style attack, remember, we're only learning information. We're running this code, but only in a prediction. So all the information we have to get out is through things like what things are evicted in the cache. So we need to think about what will we learn from what's evicted from the cache. And this access won't tell us anything because we know what argument we supplied. Therefore, we know what address that will access. But this access will tell us something because what address it accesses depends on a value we're not supposed to know. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So I think I'm out of time. I will have office hours tomorrow. And see you on Friday. Yeah, will I post this online? Yes.